So tonight is the final week, final night of this series of talks I've been giving on the Four Noble Truths. So tonight we're going to look at the what are called the practice elements: wise effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So you've established your practice. You've gone through the first two steps of right understanding, and you've set the intention to practice, and you've looked at your life, and you've got your life together in the regular day-to-day world of relative reality where we all live, and now you want to practice. And the question that immediately arises is, well, how much effort, what kind of energy, what kind of effort do I want to put into this? Ajahn Chah's book, Being Dharma, he talks quite bluntly about this. Practice really has to depend on steadfastness, fastness, and patient endurance. Some people start to practice meditation and they have ideas and desires as to how they want it to be. They expect the mind to be calm right away. But the old seeds and habits of turmoil are there. So practitioners will have to experience their ripening. In other words, all your old habits of mind are still there, and you have to deal with them, right? It's important to make effort where this distress appears. We might feel that we should be fine without such disciplines that cause us to feel bothered and oppressed. We could eat and sleep in comfort and at will. We could talk about whatever we like when we have the urge. We could go here and there as we wish, and following our impulses like this would bring well-being. The teachings of the Buddha talk about resisting, grating against things. The way to transcendence grates against the worldly. Right view grates against wrong view. Purity grates against impurity. These things are always going to be incompatible. In the scripture, there is a fable to illustrate this. Before the Buddha attained enlightenment, when he accepted and eaten rice porridge from the milkshake made Sujata, so this is after he had been living in a totally austere world for 5 years with these four or five other guys in the forest. Realized that didn't work, and he accepted rice porridge, which was like decadent, right? And within the context of how he'd been thinking. He set the dish on the surface of a southerly flowing river and made the aspiration: if I'm going to become a supremely awakened Buddha, may the dish flow north. So the river's flowing south, he puts it on the river, and he wants the dish to flow the other way. And the dish flowed north. So, what this is illustrating is that we're going against the current of our culture. This whole of this practice goes against the current of our culture. And so, this question of how much effort I have to put into it also we got to be careful. Basically, we're told, in the tradition that we all have Buddha nature, right? We're all Buddhas in the making. That we're naturally perfect. So the question says, well then, why do I have to do anything if I'm already naturally perfect? Why should I have to practice at all? And simply put, in terms of absolute reality, this may be true. In terms of absolute reality, we're all Buddhas. But we live in the world of relative reality, of this, not that. In our day-to-day lives, that's what we're dealing with. And you don't know, the capital K, know in quotes, know that you are a Buddha all the time. You keep forgetting over and over and over again. You don't experience your Buddhahood all the time. In fact, often we experience the opposite of that. So the world seems to be full of suffering And we seem to be anything but perfect. So we have to let go of this idea. And we also have to let go of all our reactive habits of mind. All these reactive habits that get in the way of us realizing and being Buddha-like. Which means first we have to see them. We have to see these reactive patterns. And how much of our life we're sort of functioning on autopilot, which we do. Which means, of course, that we have to be mindful of them. Oh, here's mindfulness again. Right? All of these 8 steps on the Eightfold Path, all interrelated, intermingle like this. So this is what we practice for, to help to see how little of our time we actually spend in the present moment. How much of our time we spend spinning in mental stories about ourselves, reliving old hurts and missing something that's no longer there, fantasizing about the future. As I like to say, 1,000 mind movies starring me. Right? We're always the star of these mind movies. Sometimes we're the villain, sometimes we're the hero, but we're always the star. So to shift these patterns of thought and reaction is not easy. So the word effort that we're using here is the translation of the Pali word virya. And the root of that word is vira, which is directly translated as warrior. So we have to be a little fierce. We have to have to do this practice sincerely and get at it takes courage, because we're going against the whole stream of our culture. Our whole stream of our culture tells us, no, just kick back and have a good time. But at the same time, we have to be really careful that we don't sort of become sort of grim, like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to be perfect right away and blah, 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 and sort of turn it into some sort of big way to succeed. Turn it into a goal. We just have to practice. And if we turn it into this goal-oriented, success-oriented mode, which is once again part of our culture, the practice can very quickly become grim. Like we get so serious. And then because it becomes grim, we go, oh, I don't want to do that, and we stop. Too much effort, too little effort. So, in right effort, traditionally, it's spoken of having 4 aspects. And I want to actually look at these, because it's quite... It's central to the Buddhist teaching, this way. These 4 aspects of right effort or wholesome effort. And the first one is to do whatever you can to prevent unwholesome mind states from arising. Seems like, duh. Well, of course that's what I'm going to do. But we don't. It's like, there we are sitting, or just in our daily life, going about our daily life, and we see an old, unwholesome pattern of thought arising. And an intention of some sort to act upon or speak based on that old pattern. If we're mindful, if we can see that that's what's happening, we can then we have a choice where we can go, oh, I don't need to do that. I don't need to fall into that old reactive pattern yet again for the 437th time this month. I can just go, no, I don't need to go there. And this isn't about repression or suppression. This is just like being wise enough to see something and going, I don't have to believe that story anymore. Because there's always a story involved, right? So this is like This arises, this understanding at this first level of wholesome effort arises because we've sort of been working on the first five steps of the Eightfold Path. We're about to do something and we go, oh wait, that's not very virtuous. Or, oh, that doesn't follow my original intention. Or, oh, from my understanding, that doesn't make sense based on my right understanding. And so we decide, no, I don't need to do that. Sometimes it's like very useful at this point when you see these things arising and you catch them at that early stage to be able to laugh. Oh God, that one again. And just have a good giggle about it. Because then it's like it loses its power. So in our day-to-day lives, this means looking and seeing about things we habitually do. You know, places where you go to, people we hang out with. And how some of those habitual patterns with other people or with other activities lead to unwholesome mind states. So this is like sort of stepping back and looking at your whole life and going, oh, does that make sense within the context of what the teachings say? Does this lead to something wholesome? No? Oh, I guess I maybe need to change my daily out in the world patterns a little bit. That's the first step in the right effort. Second step is to do whatever you can to get rid of unwholesome mind states that have already arisen. So there you are. Now you're in the midst. Instead of you didn't see it at the beginning, you're in the midst of some rant or some story or some way of beating yourself up or lost in some sort of deep sorrow about something in the past or worry about something in the future. You can see your mind spinning. And then you go, oh, I've been caught again. It's harder. This is harder to do because once you're in that spinning mind state, we have to be able to go, we have to be mindful enough to see that that's what's going on. Otherwise, we just go from that mind world to the next one, right? And part of it is like, we're programmed all the time, partly biologically, to look for what's wrong. 10,000 years ago out there on the plains, and we'd be wandering around and, you know, with our little tribe, and we'd be going, oh my God, you know, I got to look out for, you know, animals that are going to come and attack us, or another tribe that's going to come and attack us and, you know, kill us or steal my wife or steal my children or bomb, you know. It was like deeply embedded way down in our brainstem to always be looking for danger. And that's still built into our biology. So it's sort of almost like instinctually, we're always looking for what things that are wrong. And then we get caught in stories about, well, why couldn't I see that before, and blah, 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 blah. Only now we're not worried about saber-toothed tigers. We're worried about who knows what. You know, someone, you know, having a better car than me, or whatever it is we worry about these days, right? And it's way easier. Part of the problem is, once we see these things there, it's like, it's familiar. Oh, I understand. This is a familiar way of being. And it's hard to sort of go, no, actually, this is really unwholesome. And I have to do something to change it. It's much easier just to go with the flow, as they say, right? Even though the flow is unpleasant. It's easier to go with the unpleasant flow than do something about it, which takes effort. You know, so, and often we, you know, here we are, we're all worried and caught up in some story, and then we catch ourselves, we're mindful of it, and we see how unhappy this story is making us. And our mind goes, oh, you don't deserve to be happy. Or thoughts like that. I can't become like this. I have to always be on the lookout for all the things that might go wrong. And so part of this is just learning that it's okay to be happy. In fact, it's okay to be joyful. And then, you know, through right effort, you can do something like, oh, I'm caught up in this story about this rant about this person, and I can just go, okay, I see that. I see the unwholesomeness of it. I see myself caught in this unwholesome mind state. Can I just sort of change the channel? Can I offer that person methods that consciously choose to shift the channel? Might be a really skillful thing to do. And that's a way to, when you're caught in an unwholesome mind state, start to shift things. Whether it's that, or maybe I just need to sort of do some other sort of simple concentration practice and get my mind to go a little calmer and stiller, or maybe I have to drop down into the body and really pay attention to my body sensation as a way to put that story more in the background. And that's not that easy either. And part of this is also, we have to accept the fact, this is maybe the hardest part, accept the fact that sometimes what arises in our daily life is unwholesome. That we're capable of that. That we're capable of anger and fear and disparagement and all the other forms of unwholesomeness, lust. Easy to go there, right? And we have to accept the fact that that's part of who I am. I have to accept my dark side. They call it in some teachings, and that's okay. But I don't have to believe in it, accept it, go with it. I can consciously see if I can, over time, shift those patterns. Because that's all we're doing. When we catch something, and we go, oh, I'm going to shift the pattern, then it's less likely that pattern will occur with as much strength the next time. Or it might take, 50 times before that change happens, but it's going to change over time. Sometimes you have to be quite forceful to make these shifts. This is Joseph Goldstein talking about this. He's actually referring to this teaching about the five methods of dealing with unwholesome mind states. When all else fails, the Buddha suggests forcefully suppressing the unwholesome thought. One way of doing this is imagining oneself shooting down these thoughts as soon as they arise, like shooting down targets at an amusement park shooting gallery game. I found this method particularly helpful with the current unwholesome thoughts that have already been seen so many times that it's not a question of denial or suppression of feeling. Here it's an attitude that takes no quarter, but involves a sense of humor. I call this method cowboy dharma. Having a sense of humor about it is also what he's going to do. At the same time as you're being forceful, you're being lightly forceful. I don't know if maybe that's not the right word, but it's like something like that. And the other thing is, at the same time as I'm talking about this, I'm also, it's like when you hear these teachings, traditionally, people say, if something there is unwholesome, just stay with it. And that's true up to a point. It's a good idea to sort of look at these things and sort of feel them, especially feel them in the body, and the unpleasantness of the body sensations that always go along with these unwholesome patterns in mind. But I also heard Joseph say once, I thought this was really great, someone asked him about this very question. And he said, well, if you've had exactly the same sort of story occur five times, fairly close together, and you've honestly looked at it and experienced it and felt it in the body and seen it for what it does, then it's time to go, enough already. I'm going to shoot this one down. I don't have to stay with it 50 times in a row, because that'll just wear me out. So there's always a point where we can go, enough. I don't need to do this yet again. Here's another tidbit about this. This is from Mark Epstein's book, Advice Not Given. In Mark Epstein, by the way, if you're not familiar with him, is a Freudian psychotherapist and a Dharma teacher. It's an interesting combination. Brilliant, brilliant man. Right effort is not only helpful in the psychotherapy office. It is relevant in any situation in which strong emotions or habits threaten to carry people away. It takes a different kind of effort to go to an AA meeting or call one's sponsor than it does to take a drink, for example. A lot more effort. It takes a different energy to restrain oneself from saying something nasty than it does to lose one's temper. And it takes a more concerted strength to remain quiet around one's adolescent child than it does to give advice, repeated advice, when it is not welcome. It doesn't have to be an adolescent child, it could be the person you work with or whatever. You know, sometimes people just aren't open to that wise advice we have. So right effort suggests that it is possible and often desirable to gain control over one's ego impulses. Like, I'm going to tell them this because it's right. They should know this. The precondition for this is the ability to have, however underutilized, to observe our own minds and to learn how to restrain them. Sometimes right effort basically means restraint. It doesn't mean doing something. It means consciously choosing not to do something. That's equally powerful at times. To see that this is not appropriate to do this right now, for whatever reason, even though you might feel righteous about it. Don't know, but I just need to sit here and be quiet. Be still. So that's the first two aspects of right effort. And the other two are sort of like the flip side. So the third aspect of right effort is the part into the first, in a sense. Do whatever you can to cultivate wholesome mind states. Once again, this seems obvious, right? Like, well, why wouldn't I do that? You know, do things that bring about calm, joy, compassion, loving kindness, equanimity. But how often do we actually do this? Consciously choose to live your life in this way. Consciously choose to do things and consume things and connect to things that lead us towards joy and calm, as opposed to excitement or whatever else might be appealing, right? So you have to think about you have to make all these choices. These are wise choices. Am I going to do this or am I going to do that? Does it make sense for me to do this, or should I step back? And it's always based on, does this lead to wholesome mind states, or does it lead to unwholesome mind states? That's like the central question we keep having to ask ourselves. And then we consciously choose to do things that lead to more wholesome mind states. You come here, you could be, you know, watching, you know, Predator 37 rerun or something like that. But here you are sitting and hanging out and meditating and listening to Dhamma. This is a wholesome choice you made. At least I like to think I'm a wholesome choice. Sometimes. So the fourth aspect of right effort is often the most difficult, interestingly enough. When wholesome mindsets have arisen in the mind, do whatever you can to preserve them. First of all, once again, you have to actually be aware that a wholesome mind state has arisen. That in itself is a big leap. I mean, you know, you're just having a good time and you don't realize, oh, I'm calm, focused right now. I'm joyful right now. I'm whatever that's, I'm very concentrated right now. And because we're programmed to look what's wrong, you know, there we are in this wholesome, calm mind state, and we're going, oh, there must be something wrong, right, coming up any second now, because I can't be like this. This is not normal, right? Or because we judge ourselves as unworthy. I'm not good enough, holy enough, spiritual enough to be in this calm, wholesome mind state. It's way easier to see the unwholesome and the unpleasant. So the first two steps are actually easier because they're so obvious. But when we're in a wholesome mind state, we have to sort of just go, oh, that's nice. Look what's here now. I feel very calm and still right now. And that's okay, too. Because otherwise we fall into judging the fact that we're there. Maybe we shouldn't be. How can I be so calm and happy when the world is falling apart? Right? This is a classic. And that's, now I'm in an unwholesome, I just gave up that wholesome mind state and here I am in an unwholesome one again. Just like that. It's so easy just to lose it. And it doesn't, I'm not saying we should want to sort of cling to these things. I'm not saying that we should, you know, make it into like some big job, because we also have to understand that anything that arises is going to go away. So we may be in a wholesome mind state. We might be calm and still right now. But we don't know. We can't know how long it's going to last or, you know, what's going to replace it. But acknowledge it and being aware of it and acknowledging it and going, oh, this is good to hang out here. And then just be there without trying to make it last, which just makes it go away right away, because now I'm caught in desire. Now, back in an unwholesome mind state again. So it's tricky, this balance. So that's the four aspects of right effort. Do what you can so that unwholesome mind states don't arise in the first place. When they do arise, do what you can to let them go. Do whatever you can to create wholesome mind states, or create the causes, in Buddhist speak. Do whatever you can to create the causes and conditions such as a wholesome mind state might arise. Official Buddhist language, right? And when you're in when you actually notice, when you're aware, when you're mindful that a wholesome mind state has arisen, do whatever you can to maintain it. You know, sometimes when I'm sitting and I think, oh, I think I'm going to sit for 40 minutes like I usually do in the morning. And I'll be sitting there and I'll peek at the clock and it'll be almost 40 minutes and I'll go, so what? Right now. I mean, sometimes like I'm thinking, oh my God, I still have 2 more minutes. How can I last that long? You know, I mean, caught in that world. But sometimes I'm caught in the, right now I'm calm and still. Just ignore the clock. And when this dissipates eventually, which I know it will, then I'll slowly get up and go about my day. Do just something simple like that allows you to preserve something, just another minute of calm. Isn't that nice? Because you know it's going to change. Then we come to what I think of as very much the practice elements, which is, you know, right mindfulness and right concentration. And the other six steps really are just laying the foundation for this, these two. And when I say laying the foundation, I mean creating the causes and conditions such that mindfulness and or concentration might arise. Mindfulness and concentration are both just wholesome mind states. And we can't make them. We think when we're sitting here, we're practicing mindfulness. But actually, we're practicing creating the causes and conditions such that mindfulness might arise. Just a more honest assessment of things. And there's lots of different ways people practice mindfulness. I'm not saying, you know, that what I practice and teach is the only way or the best way even. But all of mindfulness practice and mindfulness itself has these interesting qualities in that are different ways of thinking about what mindfulness is. You know, usually we say mindfulness is being aware of what's arising in the moment. Good definition. But it's not the only definition, and really, when we think about mindfulness, we want to think about it as a sort of a conglomeration of these different ideas I want to present. So first of the qualities of mindfulness is not forgetting. Just not forgetting things. Staying firmly with the meditation object. Not wandering. There's an image sometimes used that when mindfulness has arisen, you should feel solid, like a post set in the ground. I used to set posts in the ground. I used to build decks and fences and stuff, right? So it's like, I know what to do. The image is very clear in my mind anyway. But it might just be like driving a nail into a piece of wood. It's like some sort of steadiness to mindfulness. But part of this is also, and this is where things get tricky again, I think. You think of that post. Well, think of some animal tied to the post for some reason. But it's on one of those, those leashes people use when they're walking their dogs. Where the leash gets really long and then the people can pull it back in. That's us. Like sometimes we can let the leash go out a little bit further because our mind is focused, is okay with the variety of what we're encountering when we go out a little further. And sometimes we've got to, press the button and pull the leash back in really tight and wrap it around the post three times, right? And that's just part of what we have to do. It's like, we can be in a state of not forgetting, but also be in a state of awareness of the world around us, or what's arising, the multiplicity of what's arising. Another way of thinking of mindfulness is presence. I like this one, actually. Not looking away. It's so easy with mindfulness to make it, I'll be mindful of all the good stuff, all the wholesome stuff. But I don't want to look at that other stuff. Aversion of things. Keeping our distance. Push that away because that's not a wholesome thing, so I can never be aware of it. The other thing is, we have to be aware of those things because that's part of what arises. So we can't only be mindful of the good stuff, the stuff that makes us happy, make that stuff. We also have to be mindful of all the difficult things that arise and be okay with that. Then another one, I talk with this a lot actually, another translation of the word sati, which is usually translated as mindfulness, another translation is simply remembering. Just remembering. Even that has like two different flavors to it. One flavor of remembering is, you're practicing, maybe practicing formally, and you've chosen your meditation object and you're noting and doing whatever in the form of the practices you're doing. And then the mind, as it always does, wanders off into some realm other than what you chose to be your focus. Then at some point, you sort of go, I'm sitting. You remember what's actually happening. Right? And then you can go back to the meditation object. So the The mindfulness is the act of remembering itself. Remembering over and over and over. Because our mind keeps wandering over and over and over. So if we keep remembering, every time we remember is a moment of pure mindfulness. So it isn't like, oh, I keep remembering, I must be doing this wrong. No, you're doing it quite right. You know, remember it. You know, like we judge ourselves if that happens instead of going, oh, look, I remember. You know, my mind wandered, but only for a couple of seconds. Sometimes it wanders for 10 minutes. So only a couple of seconds, I just did great. And even for 10 minutes, well, better than to remember than to, all of a sudden your timer goes or you look at the clock, well, I've been here 27 minutes and haven't seen my breath twice yet, which happens. The other meaning of remembering, this is one that Joseph emphasizes, is remembering what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. Just remembering that sometimes. Remembering, oh, I know what's wholesome. I can see this as unwholesome. And we remember just that. That's another aspect of remembering. And then sometimes mindfulness is often associated very directly with wisdom and simplicity. That phrase, just sit and know you're sitting. I love that phrase. I use it a lot when I teach. Because it's like, just be aware that that's what's happening right now. Right now, I'm practicing, I'm sitting. That's all. That's not to be a big deal. It's simple. It's also fits into not making up stories about what we're experiencing, which we do all the time. We'll be sitting there and something arises in the background and all of a sudden we think, is that the garbage truck? Oh, did I put out the garbage already? No, I forgot, blah, 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 blah. And there's our mind gone on some rant about how come the garbage truck's so early? They usually come later. It must be a special day. You know, our mind just goes in all these places. But make up stories about some little tiny thing that happened, and there's a whole story arises around it called proliferation, is what the official word. Actually, in Pali, it's papancha, which I like the alliterative sound of that. And I'll tell you a little story from my own practice days of how I saw this happen in the midst. After a while, I saw it happening. It took me a while. I was, this is how I met Spirit Rod. And Spirit Rod is sort of this little back porch area where you can do your walking practice, but it's right close to the meditation hall. So you can come right out of the meditation hall into this little porch space and do walking practice before you go back in for another sit. Very convenient. So I'm just back there doing my walking practice. And all that happens is there's this big whoop, like a thumping sound. And it's like, what was that? What was that thump? And it was a little bird who'd run into one of the big glass windows. And it was like, he must have been flying pretty fast because it was a pretty loud thump. You know, I go over, and there's this little bird lying on the ground. And I, oh. Like, it's obviously injured, right? I pick it up, and I hold it in my hands, like, thinking, it's still alive. What, what am I going to do now? And then I decide, I know. The office, I have to go through a couple of doors, and I can get to where the office, so someone in the office could take care of this little bird. That's my idea. So I'm holding this little bird and people are watching me because who's this guy walking around like this with a bird in his hand, right? And they're opening doors for me and I go through a couple of doors and I get to the big front patio, which is nice and sunny, and the bird is sort of, moving around a little more. So I go and I actually sit in this little bench, a little sort of stone pedestal thing, and I very carefully put the bird down on this little stone pedestal and it's standing there. But it's sort of looking at me and it's sort of twitching still. I'm actually like petting it. Like, know, it's all right. I'm talking. It's all right. You're okay. You're going to be fine. You know, talking to this bird. And then the bell rings for the next meditation session. Oh my God, what am I going to do with this bird? I can't just leave it here. One thing with spirit, there's lots of hawks. I always watch the hawks. And so there's little birds going to be sitting there, like, can't fly. The hawk will get it for sure. So I pick up the bird again and I sort of walk quickly to the office. And I say to the office, can you take care of my bird for me? And, you know, and they put it, there's a window ledge right outside the office. And I put on this window ledge right outside the office and I will watch this bird for you. I go in to sit. So guess what happens as I'm sitting? Right? All I can think about is, what's going to happen with this bird? And I come up, oh, I know, I'll go to the kitchen, I'll get one of those empty boxes they have, and I'll fill it with some grass and get some seeds from the, you know, there's all these different seeds and stuff, that, you know, in a condominium area that the bird can eat. And I can keep this bird in my room until it's feeling better. And I think, oh, I can't do that. What if I'm, you know, I can't carry the bird around with me. You know, when I go and the bird starts flying around in the room and pooping all over the place, I can't do that. And I, oh, wait, this teacher, I know this teacher is always talking about animals. I'll get her to take care of the bird. And it's like my whole 45 minutes of sitting practice is coming up with all these different ways of solving this problem of getting this bird happy and taking care of it. And bell rings. I go out. I go over to the office. The bird's not there. I knock on the door. Oh, bird flew away after about 5 minutes. But the bird was in my mind, and this whole story, just I built out of just nothing more than one sound. And this whole drama unfolded in my mind that went on for an hour. How we, you know, we react in certain ways about things, and it was like, it was sweet, you know, it was a sort of a sweet experience, but at the same time, it was like just like total mind drama that had no connection to reality as it really was. I mean, and then who knows what happened to that bird? The bird flew away, and there was lots of birds. I kept sort of thinking, well, maybe the bird will come and back to me and sit on my shoulder or something and tell me it's okay. You know, have weird, more fantasies, right? Nonsense. This is what in Joseph Goldstein's book, there's this great description of mindfulness. This is actually Bhikkhu Bodhi's description that Joseph is quoting here. In the practice of mindfulness, the mind is trained to remain in the present, open, quiet, and alert, contemplating the present event. All judgments and interpretations have to be suspended, or if they occur, just registered and dropped. The task is simply to note whatever comes up just as it's occurring, riding the changes of events in the way a surfer rides the waves of this on the sea. The whole process is a way of coming back into the present, of standing in the here and now, without slipping away, without being swept away by tides of distracting thoughts. To practice mindfulness is thus a matter not so much of doing, but of undoing. Undoing our habitual patterns of distraction. Not a matter of doing, but of undoing. I like that expression. So then, this last thing on the Eightfold Path is concentration, which could be like a 3-week lecture. But I just want to mention, you know, that basically concentration has these two forms, and both of them we use, and we need to mix them somehow skillfully. First is like mindfulness. Mindfulness leads to concentration if we're constantly, skillfully noting one thing and then the next and the next amidst all of the change. So the object of the meditation keeps changing. Maybe sometimes we note the same thing four or five times before it dissipates, right? But the object keeps changing, but the concentration is there to keep us connected to the process itself. That's one form of concentration. Concentration on changing objects. And then there's concentration on a single point, like metta, like using just the breath as the concentration object, like deciding not to open up to the wide world. And there's also things like, you know, in other Buddhist practices, there's things like, you know, visualization of bodhisattvas and mantras and all kinds of other forms of concentration practice. But within the tradition I'm teaching and practicing in, there's really, there's this open-ended, you know, just paying attention to whatever is arising. There's this shutting down in the sense of still having something to be noting, but consciously choosing a very small subset of what's arising. And then there's, like I said, metta, which is a, you know, really, like, here's this simple meditation object, this set of phrases we keep repeating. So it's a different form of concentration. And the interesting thing is, we keep thinking about these things as separate things, right? And they're really all skillful means, it's all they are. And these various forms of concentration practice are just variations on the theme of, like, let's get the mind focused. And at various times in any one formal practice time, you might shift back and forth between all three of these. You know, you decided to sort of have this really open process and just put anything that's arising and everything's okay. And you get really sort of scrambled. You know, we all have days when we get scrambled, right? And then we go, oh, maybe I should step back and just focus on the breath for a while. Or I'm getting really scrambled, but it's a story about some person, and I'm really invested in the energy of it and the emotion of it. And I realize that, and I go, oh, let's shift and offer that person metta. Well, now I've just shifted to a different form of concentration. But it's all the same practice. It's just different skill beings, different forms of the same practice. They're all interrelated. And we learn one part of this practice is learning to skillfully shift back and forth based on what's happening right now. Like not sitting down and going, this is what I'm going to do. As if you knew what was going to happen for the next 40 minutes of practice time. As if you knew. But you don't. You haven't got a clue. Who knows what's going to arise in the next 40 minutes? Not me. So, can I be sort of flexible enough to have all of these different skillful means in my kit bag, so to speak, and be able to sort of gradually learn to move amongst them, but keep concentration going all the time, using totally different methods sometimes within the same practice period. Might be a really skillful thing to do as you learn to do it and not be so rigid. No, I can only do this. And it's like, that's what makes, it's finding a balance of all these things. Having the right amount of effort, being mindful, steady like a post, whatever, you know, the images you like. And then concentrating in any of these different forms, depending on what's going on. Those three together, we can get all those working together, that leads towards a more fruitful practice. But then, here's an interesting thing that happens. You know, we sort of presented this, and I mentioned this the very first talk I gave about this. We sort of thought about this, the Eightfold Path is a straight line. But what really happens is that as we get more skillful, as we learn to have this sort of kit bag and use different pieces and get more concentration and be more mindful, we come all the way back around to the very first step. But because now you, because of what you're seeing and what's arising in your practice, you're going, oh, your understanding is getting deeper. So you go back and you look at right understanding again. And then based on that more precise understanding, you might change your thoughts on what your intentions are and so forth. And so it's like practice is like a spiral. It's going around in a circle, going around and around. You know, there's a Pema Chodron image. And she says we often think of practice as like going up a mountain, like we're going around and around, but that they're going around, we're going higher and higher up the mountain. She says, no, no. Think of practice sort of like a pit mine. Have you ever been seeing a pit mine? It's like, it's circular, it's a spiral, and it goes down deeper and deeper and deeper. That's what we're really doing. We're going down deep, deep, deep. Like we're going around in the circle, deeper, 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 deeper. We're not going up, we're going down. Interesting way to think about it. That we're going deeper into the practice. We're not rising up, grounding deeper and deeper into the practice. Just turn into this view. A little bit of Mary Oliver to finish here. It's called The Song of the Builders. On a summer morning, I sat down on a hillside to think about God, a worthy pastime. Near me, I saw a single cricket who was moving the grains of the hillside this way and that way. How great was its energy! How humbled its effort! Let us hope we will always be like this, each of us going on in our own inexplicable ways, building the universe. Very good description.